Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Today, Steve and I are going to be talking about Robin Hood. We all know the tale and the legends of the outlaw and his merry men that lived in Sherwood Forest, hated Sheriff of Nottingham, and robbed from the rich to give to the poor. Legend tells that Robin Hood could pinpoint a target at 300 yards and hit it dead center. Robin was so good with his bow that there is an archery shot named after him, called a Robin Hood. The shot in archery refers to an event when someone hits a bullseye with their first arrow, and then with their second arrow, it hits directly into the back of the initial arrow. So we're going to talk a bit about the legend of Robin Hood, the adventures of Robin Hood from 1938, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves from 1991. We're also going to talk a bit about the DC character Green Arrow. But before we get started, was there anything you wanted to say, Steve?
Sure. Robin Hood is one of the more enduring characters of English folklore, and I think for good reason. He's one of the earliest known examples of what today we call the gentleman thief. He comes from a genteel background. He's a son of the nobility. He's a stylish rogue. He's audacious and bold in his plans. He's always a step ahead of the law, and he also has a heart of gold. So he's a predecessor of modern heroic thieves, and he probably influenced more than a few of them. I mean, even my own Night Spider character is a hero in that mold, so I'll openly honor that intellectual debt. He also had a huge influence on archer heroes, but we'll discuss that when we talk about Green Arrow. But I think the reason why Robin Hood stands out among the many such rogues in fiction is that he's a folk hero who represents the rightful king and the English people. He's not a thief because he's stealing for himself. I mean, he's already rich and powerful, so he doesn't need to do that. But Robin sees the suffering of the English people at the hands of people like Prince John, Guy of Gisborne, and the Sheriff of Nottingham, and he decides to do something about it. His acts of thievery are acts of revolution against the tyrants who are oppressing the common folk. What Robin is doing is, in effect, guerrilla warfare against a usurper prince in defense of King Richard and the English people. He's stealing from the agents of Prince John's regime, and then he's returning the money to the people who were victimized by them. So in the end, the legend of Robin Hood represents uncompromising resistance to tyranny and a corrupt system. It's an inspiring legend, and there's a romanticism to his story that's kept it in popular consciousness for hundreds of years.
It is an interesting legend and a particular favorite of mine since I saw Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves with my sister in 1991. Actually, I immediately came home from the theater and started drawing a comic book I was going to make about Robin Hood, and I've actually been hooked ever since. You know, most historians will agree that the tale of Robin Hood is based in truth, but the stories we know are built to both fact and fiction. Robin Hood and tales of him have been around for over 800 years and potentially longer. The date is based solely on what records have survived. The origins of the legend, as well as his historical context, have been debated over for centuries. There are numerous references to historical figures with similar names that have been proposed as possible evidence of his existence, some dating back to the late 13th century. The first reference to Robin Hood comes from 1262, and it was no doubt an alias or a nickname given to a criminal. But there are documents that list at least a dozen more criminals throughout the next decade with the same name. It's almost like it was a term used to describe an outlaw, like he's a hood in the sticks. The surname Hood, by any spelling, was also fairly common because it referred to either a hooder, someone who makes hoods, or alternatively someone who wore a hood as a head covering. But when you put Robin in front of that, it specifies a specific person. From what I can tell, the connotation in the name Robin Hood is that it wearing a hood was associated with criminality in some fashion. Like, I don't know, like maybe like they're trying to hide themselves or something. And so it's suspicious or something. I'm not exactly quite sure where that goes, but historians and folklorists have mooted suggestions that Robin Hood was a stock alias used in reference to just bandits in general. But I think that the hood part of the name was at least to some degree. Either way, it is therefore unsurprising that medieval records mentioned a number of people called Robert Hood or Robin Hood, some of whom were known criminals. I will say others might have taken up Robin's name inspired by the tales of him or even called been called Robin Hood-like, but I believe there was an original Robin Hood. Before the 12th century, tales were passed on orally through minstrels and bards that added to the tale and combined elements from various people, given the name Robin Hood to create the legends. His exploits might have even started earlier than 1262 with the tenant farmer turned outlaw named Robert Hood that went to court on July 25th, 1225. The next year, the name was Hobby Hood and then Gilbert Robert Hood. But the story begins when a wealthy nobleman was killed in Nottingham and his son took a secret identity and rose up to avenge him and gathered up some friends to help him. Operating from a secluded hideaway, they would appear out of nowhere and defend the poor and fight injustice through guerrilla warfare.
I don't think it's an accident that Hood has come to mean a criminal in modern times. Probably that term itself comes from Robin Hood and it got adopted as language has evolved over time. But I think your account of the historical facts is pretty solid from my own understanding of them. There have been attempts to confirm the legend surrounding Robin Hood, but none of them has really panned out. There was an episode of Expedition Unknown where Josh Gates even digs into these legends, and the details are enlightening, even if they don't confirm much. But there are elements here and there that do ring true to historical fact, so there probably is at least one person who did inspire the tales, maybe even more. I don't think that there was an actual person called Robin Hood necessarily, but there probably are real people who inspire the folk tales. The most likely real person behind the tales is a man called Roger Godbird, and he fits many of the recognized elements of Robin Hood. He was a supporter of Simon the Earl of Leicester during the reign of Henry III. So we're talking at least 100 years or so after King Richard's reign, but other elements align pretty well. Godbird was an outlaw who traveled with a bandit crew. He operated out of Sherwood Forest. He was an enemy of the Sheriff of Nottingham. He was even jailed in Nottingham Castle. There have been others who might have influenced the legend of Robin Hood as well, including those that you talked about, Mike, but Godbird seems like one of the most significant ones. To be fair, though, this theory hasn't been firmly established, even though the parallels look pretty solid.
They certainly sound pretty solid. And placing him in the time of King Richard's was actually a later addition. So, I mean, I'm willing to say that is as good as any of the other theories that I have heard on his identity. I think the real problem in discovering who he really was is that I don't know how far back the stories go. And I don't honestly think that anyone else does either. The problem is that manuscripts that might have revealed the truth of it have all either crumbled to dust or been lost to time. But I imagine the tales had to have been around, probably in oral traditions, as I mentioned, for some time before the 13th century, as they were popular enough to be referenced in other literature by the late 14th century. Keep in mind, information was not so readily available as it is today. Something would have needed to be talked about a great deal to pass from town to town like that. The first reference to Robin Hood in literature I could find comes from the Rhymes of Robin Hood, from an alliterative poem by Piers Plowman from the 1370s. There is a quote from Friar Dawes' reply in 1402 that reads, "Many men speak of Robin Hood and never shot his bow." That actually later became a proverb. I can only take that to be similar to the modern saying of about walking in someone's shoes, in that they speak about Robin without really knowing who he was or why he did the things that he did. Apparently, Robin Hood and tales of him were quite popular if a saying about him like that became a common proverb. His popularity is also evidenced by a complaint in Dives and Popper from 1405 to 1410 that people would rather listen to tales and songs of Robin Hood than attend mass. Speaking of religious references, Robin Hood was mentioned in a Lollard tract, along with folk heroes such as Guy of Warwick, Beavis of Hampton, and Sir Libius. For the sake of clarity, a Lollard was someone who was only educated, if at all, in English and followed the teachings of John Wycliffe. But more to my point, mentioning Robin Hood among such names as Guy of Warwick in particular suggests that Robin Hood tales could have been around in the 13th century, a full 100 years before Piers Plowman mentioned him in the 1370s. I say this because Guy of Warwick dates back to the 1200s.
Well, the 1200s also makes sense because that's when Roger Godbird was active as an outlaw. So maybe it could have started with him, and then the story got embellished, changed, and exaggerated over time. I'm guessing that there were a lot of oral traditions that were passed down in the 13th and 14th centuries, and that caused the story to morph over time. The problem with these kinds of legends is that it's very much like playing telephone. The story gets retold so often and in so many different ways that what you end up with is never how the story starts. So you get something that's pretty much unrecognizable when all is said and done. But the written stories don't even get started until centuries later. So why don't we talk about those, Mike?
Sure thing, Steve. But I will say that Roger Godbird is moving up on my top few contenders for the real Robin Hood. I think you might be on to something there. But the stuff I mentioned before may be the earliest references to the character, Robin Hood. But the earliest surviving copies of the ballads that tell his story date back to the latter 1400s through about 1510. The earliest is Robin Hood and the Monk, written after 1450. The next was a guest of Robin Hood from 1500, and in 1503 came Robin Hood and the Potter. Well, Robin Hood and Guy of Gisborne, which introduces the Sheriff of Nottingham's companion, survived in a book from 1475. It is regarded by many as potentially older than even Robin Hood and the Monk. But many things in modern audiences would find familiar were already well established by then. Things like the Nottingham setting, Robin Hood's exceptional skill as an archer, his merry men, his preference toward the lower classes, and animosity with the Sheriff of Nottingham are all clear. In these first stories, however, Robin Hood's character and his merry men's characters were a bit different than our modern perceptions of the character. The Robin in these early texts was rougher edged than what we're used to today. In Robin Hood and the Monk, Robin is quick-tempered and violent. He even assaults Little John for beating him in an archery contest and refuses to pay him at all when he loses the bet and they couldn't decide on a payout. In that same story, a monk sees Robin when he attempts to go to church and informs the sheriff, which leads to his capture. When Little John and Much the Miller's son see the monk later with a little page, aka a young boy, Little John kills the monk for his treachery, and Much the Miller's son casually kills the young boy so that he cannot tell anyone what happened while rescuing Robin from prison.
You know, that is a bit darker than what you typically see from the Robin Hood than most people are familiar with, but I actually think it makes Robin and his band more interesting. I could see Robin being a hot-tempered and violent character at times, especially since this is a man who fought in the Crusades. He'd be all too used to violence because of what he'd gone through. A Robin that is driven to oppose the sheriff by anger against perceived injustice, that is a plausible take. And as unsavory as it is, I can even see the merry men silencing people if it meant not being discovered by the sheriff. They're fighting a war, and as a soldier, I think Robin would treat it that way, even if it meant killing people who get in the way. It's definitely not the kid-friendly version of the character that you see in the Disney movies, but there are always unfortunate casualties in a war, and so it does make unfortunate sense. I'm surprised that nobody's tried to adapt more of those elements in modern portrayals, because it could give us a well-rounded version of Robin Hood.
He could definitely be a more layered character if they added in that stuff. It certainly makes sense, too, when you put it in the perspective of fighting a war and Robin Hood and his merry men being soldiers. At the same time, I can't help but be bothered by Much the Miller's son's just killing that young boy. That seems to cross over into war crime territory, even in that perspective. It just goes too far, even if they had a hatred of clergy, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah, I'll definitely agree that killing children is going way too far. I'd like to think that Robin would have a problem with that, even if it was done for what Much thought was for a good reason. But I've noticed that Much seems willing to bloody his hands more than a lot of the merry men typically do. I mean, we even see that in the 1938 film, where Much straight up assassinates one of Prince John's agents by himself, all on his own initiative. I didn't used to look too closely at him before, but I realize now that Much is hardcore and willing to make the bloodier decision so that Robin doesn't have to. So it could just be that Much is an outlier and not representative of the band's typical morality. But let's get back to the tales and what they say about the group.
Sure. But I will say that you make a good point about Much the Miller's son. In the light of it not reflecting the beliefs or practices of Robin Hood and his merry men, it does make it easier to swallow that he does those things. But as you say, let's get back to talking about the others. In the story, a guest of Robin Hood, Little John, wants to have a feast because Robin is hungry. But Robin declines unless he can eat with a suitable guest, like a knight or a nobleman, someone who is good. But check this out. He's going to charge his guest for the meal. And to pay for the feast, Robin says that bishops and archbishops are supposed to be tied up, beaten, and robbed. So that's what they do. Of course, we also see the type of people these clergymen were in the same tale. The abbot of St. Mary's is willing to seize Sir Richard at the Lee's lands because he has grown poor while fighting for them overseas and cannot pay his debt. Let that sink in for a minute. Sir Richard at the Lee got poor while fighting for them overseas, and now that he's home and has no money, they're going to take what lands he has left to pay his debts as if his service meant nothing. That is some cold shit. Mm-hmm. Finding Sir Richard at the Lee's sorrowful and tattered clothes on the side of the road, Little John invited Sir Richard at the Lee to the feast. After the feast is over, Robin asks for a payment for the meal, which was apparently customary for a knight to do. But Sir Richard at the Lee did not have enough money to pay for the meal and told Robin why. Robin Hood, after hearing Sir Richard at the Lee's story, gives him £400 on the grounds that he would pay him back, an oath the knight swore by the Virgin Mary, who is sacred to Robin. But after paying the debt with the abbot, Sir Richard at the Lee returned to Robin to pay him back along with 100 bows and 100 arrows. But Robin Hood forgave his debt because on the knight's way to pay Robin, he helped a yeoman who was in trouble, and for that Robin called him a friend. What's more, Robin gave him 400 more pounds to get a new horse, a harness, and clothes and stuff, and even said that the knight could come back to him if he ever needed any spending money. That's not exactly robbing from the rich to give to the poor, but I think it does show Robin's heart for the suffering of good folk. It also shows a characteristic about Robin I did not know about, and that is that he respects and rewards those who act to protect others, and in that way believes as he does. I think this type of thing is also reflective of why his men might have even followed him.
It does, and that is a really cool story. I mean, Robin may be a thief, but he's a thief who's concerned with the welfare of others. One other point of interest with this story is that Robin is also preying on members of the church, and really they would have been acceptable targets for Robin's band. There was a lot of corruption within the church, and the church probably would have been cozy with King John's government. I mean, bishops would have typically been on the king's council around that time, so you probably would have seen them on the side of Prince John, and it would have benefited them to have been on John's good side at that time. Moreover, medieval bishops were often seen providing troops for the king's army, who probably would have been sent after Robin Hood and his men. So it really makes sense that the church would have done what they had done in that story. But Robin clearly did not hate every member of the church. Friar Tuck, for instance, was a loyal member of the Merry Men. But I think he'd had no qualms in targeting bishops that were fleecing the people or colluding with the agents of Prince John. But I think you have more to say about Robin Hood and his relationship with religion, right?
I do, Steve. The first time it is stated that Robin Hood stole from the rich to give to the poor was not until John Stowe's Annals of England in 1592, about a century after the publication of A Guest of Robin Hood. But this Robin Hood simultaneously has a great devotion to the Virgin Mary and special regard for women as a result of this devotion. What's interesting about that is that while a devotion to Mary suggests Catholicism, Robin Hood was also believed in anti-clericalism, which means that he believed in a separation of church and state, and was likely against Roman Catholicism. In these early tales, Robin Hood is a yeoman, which is neither a knight, a peasant, or a husband, but something in between, possibly a small landowner or an artisan like a miller. Both Robin Hood's and the Merry Men's social status as yeomen is evidenced in their early ballads by the fact that they use swords and not quarterstaffs. Quarterstaffs were typically the weapon of the lesser class. The only character to use a quarterstaff in the early ballads is the potter. Robin Hood never uses a staff until the 17th century ballad Robin Hood and Little John, from popular ballads by Francis James Child. However, folks like Richard Grattan, who wrote a Chronicle at Large in 1569, associated Robin Hood with the gentry as well, who were landowners that lived off the renting of their land, i.e. nobles.
That sounds right to me. Robin and his men typically use weapons that are associated with the lower classes. Robin was good with a sword, and we see versions that use one, but he's most associated with the English longbow. That's another weapon associated with the lower classes in English society, because the longbow would have been used for hunting, and it would have been relatively easy to make. The quarterstaff is another very simple weapon that would have been used by commoners like Little John. Robin himself is certainly of a slightly higher status than his followers, but not so high to disconnect him from the common folk. So he tends to be either a yeoman, a knight, or a minor landowner, or a low-ranking lord of some sort.
Actually, Robin Hood being portrayed as a lord kind of leads into the next thing I was going to talk about. In the life of Robin Hood, found in the Sloane manuscripts from the 14th and 15th century, the real-life Robin Hood of Locksley was born in 1160 in Loxerley, most likely modern-day Loxley, in South Yorkshire. Locksley fought in the Crusades along Richard the Lionheart before returning to England to find his land seized by the evil Sheriff of Nottingham, not Prince John. So there are some variations on that story. That version of the story seems to fit more in line with the older stories, which have the Sheriff of Nottingham as the antagonist of the story. I suppose it could have been a blend of both, with the sheriff being the main person Robin Hood interacted with, even if Prince John was the Blofeld, if you'll excuse the James Bond reference.
Actually, that's not a bad analogy. Prince John is the big bad pulling the strings, even if Robin typically fought either the sheriff or Guy of Gisborne. I mean, he's basically the Palpatine to Darth Vader, represented by the sheriff. Anyway, it sounds like the Robin Hood of the legends is a blend of various different things, depending on what was added in the retelling. So, I mean, you have the Robin of Locksley who fought in the Crusades, and there's the influence of Roger Godbird and other medieval bandits. So even though historical elements are garbled and mashed up, the result is a pretty fascinating character with real archetypal power.
Robin Hood is very fascinating, especially looking at how the character has evolved like this. But let's switch gears a bit and talk a little bit about Robin Hood's merry men. Several familiar names are among his companions in the earliest stories between the latter 1400s to 1510. Names like Little John, Much the Miller's Son, and Will Scarlet as Will Scarluck or Scathelock are in the earliest stories, Robin Hood and the Monk and Robin Hood and the Sheriff of Nottingham. Little John is Robin Hood's chief lieutenant over the Merry Men. Little John got his name ironically from his giant frame. He was typically portrayed as a 7-foot-tall quarterstaff master, and he and Robin first met when they fought on a log bridge across a river. Little John was not alone, though. Much the Miller's Son is the companion of Little John, and the two of them are often seen as the oldest members of the Merry Men. Much the Miller's Son is also a formidable fighter. Will Scarlet is also listed among the Robin Hood's merry men. Friar Tuck has been around since the play titled Robin Hood and the Sheriff of Nottingham from 1475, and Maid Marian, the heroine of the Robin Hood adventures, while not in the earliest manuscripts, is fully integrated into the legend in two plays by 1600 as Robin's lover. Maid Marian commanded high respect in Robin's circle for her courage and independence, as well as her beauty and loyalty. For this reason, she is celebrated by feminist commentators as one of the earliest strong female characters in English literature. And speaking of Maid Marian and Friar Tuck, they were believed to be additions made because of the late medieval and early modern day May Day games and festivities. During said festivities, the Robin Hood games or plays were done. The first recorded time this happened was in 1426 at Exeter in Devon in southwest England. Unfortunately, the reference to Robin Hood games does not mention how widespread the custom was. However, the games are known to have flourished by the latter 15th and 16th centuries. Last but not least, we have to talk about Robin Hood's nemesis, the Sheriff of Nottingham. Throughout his appearances in the stories, he is always an unjust tyrant who both mistreats the people and forces unaffordable taxes on them. It is stealing from him to give back to the people that earns Robin Hood the reputation of stealing from the rich to give to the poor.
Just like with Robin Hood himself, the companions were also gradually added with each of the retellings. I'm pretty doubtful that any of them really existed, but there could be grains of truth here and there. Still, some were clear inventions by later writers like Maid Marian, who wasn't in any of the original tales. Little John and Much tend to be pretty consistent, so there could be something to those characters. And the Sheriff of Nottingham is definitely a real office. In fact, there's a Sheriff of Nottingham in the present day, even if the position has been reduced to a ceremonial role. We just don't know anything concrete about who the Sheriff of the Tales was beyond his title. There is a solid candidate, though. Philip Mark was the sheriff during the reign of the real King John, so he tends to be connected to the legend. And Philip Mark was really well disliked, so much so that a call for his removal was included in the Magna Carta. So that's another small historical element that might have been woven into the legends.
Wow, in the Magna Carta? Yep. That is no small document to be mentioned in. I mean, damn. They must have really hated that guy. He certainly does seem to fit the bill of the much-hated character from the story. But we have just about come to the end of the tales of Robin Hood from history, and that leaves us with the alleged death of the famous hero. All versions of the Robin Hood story give the same account of his death. As he grew older and became ill, he went with Little John to Kirkless Priory near Huddersfield to be treated by his aunt, the prioress. But a certain Sir Roger de Doncaster persuaded her to murder her nephew, and the prioress slowly bled Robin to death. With the last of his strength, he blew his horn, and Little John came to his aid, but too late. Little John placed Robin's bow in his hand and carried him to a window from where Robin managed to shoot off one arrow. Robin asked Little John to bury him where the arrow landed, which he did. A mound in Kirkless Peak within bowshot of the house can still be seen and is said to be his last resting place. Little John's grave can be seen in Hathersage Churchyard in Derbyshire. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, this is a really cool story. This version of events probably did not happen the way it was told. There was some investigation done on this question by modern scientists. They found the location in Kirklees that Robin would have most likely fired the arrow from, and they scanned the ground with modern equipment in a wide radius around that location. There was nothing buried in that location. So the general consensus is that Robin Hood wasn't buried in Kirklees. However, there is evidence that Roger Godbird is connected to Kirklees, and that adds credibility to the idea that he was one of the historical influences on Robin Hood. Apparently, Roger Godbird is actually buried in Loxley, and scans of the grounds indicated that there is a body buried at that site. But the really interesting bit of information, get this, there are church records that prove that Roger Godbird's grave was moved to Loxley from Kirklees Priory. So it could be that Godbird had actually died in Kirklees, and his body was moved to Loxley later for burial. There are way too many similarities between Godbird and Robin Hood to ascribe to sheer coincidence. If nothing else, I think it's clear that Godbird's life had at least some influence on the character.
It would certainly seem so. I mean, if he was not the Robin Hood of legend, his life was without a doubt used as a model for later portrayals. In fact, speaking of later portrayals, let's get into our discussion of the Robin Hood films. Of course, while there were other Robin Hood films, mostly silent movies to my knowledge, the best place to start when it comes to Robin Hood films has got to be The Adventures of Robin Hood. The Adventures of Robin Hood came out in 1938, utilizing the three-strip Technicolor process, which was a pretty big deal as it was the first time Warner Brothers had ever used the Technicolor process. In fact, with its estimated $2 million budget, imagine that, $2 million in 1938, it was the most expensive film Warner Brothers had ever made up to that point. It was produced by Hal B. Wallace and Henry Blonky. And The Adventures of Robin Hood strangely had two directors, Michael Curtis and William Keeley. The Adventures of Robin Hood was written by Norman Riley Raine and Seton I. Miller. The film stars Errol Flynn as Robin Hood, Olivia de Havilland as Maid Marian, Basil Rathbone as Guy of Gisborne, Claude Rains as the punchable King John, Melville Cooper plays the High Sheriff of Nottingham, Patrick Knowles as Will Scarlet, Ian Hunter as King Richard the Lionheart, Eugene Paulette as Friar Tuck, and Alan Hale Sr., who plays Little John. Hale had played the same character in Douglas Fairbanks' 1922 version of the film and went on to play him again in Rogues of Sherwood Forest, released by Columbia Pictures in 1950. So, I mean, he played that role he played spanned 28 years and three films.
Wow. I'll admit that I'm a huge fan of Errol Flynn's Swashbucklers, so I can add a few things here. Although Robin Hood was the film that catapulted Flynn to stardom, many of these people had been working together for years. In fact, a few of them go all the way back to Captain Blood, which was Flynn's first swashbuckler. Michael Curtiz was the director there as well, though he directed that solo. And Olivia de Havilland and Basil Rathbone worked with Flynn on that film, too. In fact, there was a period of many years where Flynn and de Havilland were such an iconic couple that people couldn't imagine them paired off with anyone else. I think there were 8 films together over the course of 6 years. Basil Rathbone is also my favorite Flynn villain actor. He's best known for Sherlock Holmes Today, but I mean, he's really, really good as the villain in these Swashbucklers. We've talked about Claude Rains before in our discussion of The Invisible Man, but this point bears repeating. Claude Rains is an amazing actor in just about anything he's in, but he shines in villainous roles, and he is so detestable as Prince John. They had the exact right cast on this one, and the result is a classic film.
I will add that there was not a moment that Rains was on screen in The Adventures of Robin Hood that I did not wish him physical harm. That man has one of the most punchable faces I have ever seen in my life. But that aside, I think that is actually evidence in and of itself of your point about the actor, Steve, that he just really does that villain role so well. But let's talk about the story we got in The Adventures of Robin Hood. It seems to me that The Adventures of Robin Hood blends things from the earliest stories with some of the latter versions to create a new amalgamated version of the legends. Like, for instance, I talked about how Robin Hood was a bit rougher edge than in the later versions, and I feel like they gave Robin Hood a bit of an edge here, even if it's more of a rebellious streak. You have many of the same elements from the classic ballads, like how he met Little John, and that he was an exceptional archer, and that the very first merry men we see him with was Will Scarlet. They seem to disconnect much to Miller's son from Little John for some reason. I'm not sure, but they come in around the same time, so I suppose that works. I like that Robin Hood calls the forest Greenwood, like in the old ballads, right? But rather than just call it Sherwood all the time. I thought that was a nice way to do that, nice callback to it. I also like that they went with the Robin of Locksley version of Robin Hood. I feel like that gives it a sense of real history.
Oh, likewise. I feel like they take a little bit of license here and there, but it's consistent with a fair chunk of the history as well as the old tales. But more importantly, I feel like Adventures of Robin Hood got the tone down better than most of the later films. The movie's lighthearted and fun, and it has that flavor of a folktale that we don't see too often in these movies. I think that's a major reason why this movie has endured for so long after decades of adaptations. I also want to add what a swaggering badass that Errol Flynn's Robin is in this movie. After the scene where Robin drives off the sheriff's men for accosting Much the Miller's son, he takes the deer that Much killed and walks straight into Prince John's dinner with the nobles. He openly disses Guy of Gisborne in front of Prince John, for which he actually gets a compliment for this, takes his seat at dinner, and then openly accuses everyone in the room of treason against King Richard and declares revolt to the prince's face with the death of her or death speech. That is just asking to be hanging from a noose, and everyone in the room knows it. But Robin is absolutely defiant. Robin then pulls off a daring escape from the castle, killing a number of the prince's men on the way out. All of this with no help from the merry men or anyone else. And so much of this is made believable, though, because of Errol Flynn's physical presence, charisma, and sheer swagger. He brings a lot of authority to his version of Robin, and he's a believable leader. This version of Robin Hood has some huge brass balls to even try something like that, much less do it with that level of conviction and panache. It is just a brilliant establishing scene.
To quote a certain movie, he has industrial size. That scene, while I feel is a bit over the top, certainly does establish Robin's character and his relationship with the established authority. I will also agree that Flynn's charisma is really what sells that scene. So let's talk about the parts from the film that were taken right from the stories of legend. There are several bits out of The Guest of Robin Hood that are almost directly used in The Adventures of Robin Hood. The first would be the archery contest that was announced as a trap for Robin Hood and Robin winning the contest. While it ends a little differently in the story, the archery contest and the adventures of Robin Hood comes from the guest of Robin Hood. In the story, the arrow that was the prize had a head and feathers of red gold and a shaft of white silver. And in the movie, it's just solid gold. Also, both Robin and Gilbert with the white hands split the wand of the arrow three times. But on the fourth shot, Robin did better and won the prize. Also, it is implied that the sheriff broke his word that those who came to the archery contest would do so in safety in the story. I say this because when the sheriff and his men shot a volley of arrows at Robin Hood and his men as they tried to leave, Robin curses him for breaking his word. Many of Robin's merry men, although they are not called that in the story, are injured in that volley of arrows, including Little John, who takes an arrow to the knee. Damn, that must have hurt. Also, there is no mention of Maid Marian in this early story, as she did not become a part of the legend until much later.
Now, this is a part of the legend that gets adapted quite a bit. I remember it was used in the Disney animated version as well, but it's one of those elements that endures because it really works. It makes sense that the sheriff would use the archery contest as a trap for Robin, given that he's well known for being the best archer in England. So it gives Robin that moment of awesomeness, followed by an exciting escape attempt as the sheriff tries to tighten the noose on him. I feel like the movie portrayed that story pretty well. That version of Robin has a very noticeable flaw, though, and that's his ego. Marian describes him as reckless in this film, and I don't think that's quite true. He's brash and impudent, sure, but he usually has a plan behind all the audacious things he does. His real problem is that the same pride that allows him to pull off these bold schemes ends up working against him here. This time, he really didn't have a great plan for getting out of the situation, which is a bit unlike Robin in most of the film, but he insists on taking the risk because he felt like the reward was worth it. And up to that point, he'd been making fools of Prince John and his goons. Robin just got a bit arrogant on this one. I mean, maybe a bit too drunk on success. And he had to learn some humility. And though he doesn't openly admit it, I think he really does learn his lesson from his capture. Robin starts relying on other people to help him more after this, especially Marian. And he fights smarter again after the setback.
That is a classic character arc. The idea of the thing that allows a hero to do what they do is also the very thing that can bring them down. And that archery contest in the Robin Hood legend is a great example of that. I will say that the adventures of Robin Hood makes this situation less costly than in the story. And I think it suffers a bit because of this. The realization that he needed to change and that his decisions and that the cost lives that we see in the story is less weighty without losing some of his men and Little John being injured badly. But I mean, that's just my opinion.
Oh, that's a totally fair take. I don't think we would necessarily have seen that happen in a film from around that time, but at least the issue is acknowledged even in a subtle way. But why don't we get back to the influences for the film?
Sure. The second scene taken from the guest of Robin Hood is when the king and his men arrive in the greenwood dressed as monks in the black robes. They meet up with Robin and his merry men, and Robin takes the reins of the king's horse and says, "We are but poor yeomen of the forest who live by the king's deer. Share with us some of your wealth as an act of charity." The king says that he only has 40 pounds, having spent much during the last 2 weeks entertaining the kings and his lords. But if he had 100 pounds, he would give Robin half. In the movie, King Richard says that he only has 60 marks, and Robin says, "We'll call it 30 marks." But in The Guest of Robin Hood, Robin takes 40 pounds, counts out 20 pounds, and returns 20 pounds to the disguised king. "Our great king bids you come to Nottingham," the king says, and shows Robin the royal seal. In the movie, Robin Hood says any friend of Richard is free of this forest. In the story, Robin is a bit more poetic in his praying, saying that, "I love no man in all the world so much, so well as I do my king. Welcome is my lord's seal." But in the story and in the film, Robin invites the disguised king and his men to dinner.
Yeah, as you point out in the movie, Robin also offers free passage through Sherwood to the disguised king and his men because they're friends of King Richard. The king could unmask at any time and put an end to it, but he doesn't. It's clear that Richard doesn't reveal himself because he's trying to learn about Robin Hood and whether or not he can be trusted, whether he's just a brigand or if he's a true king's servant. Richard knows he needs allies that he can trust, given how many people have already sold out to Prince John. So in that moment, as well as the feast, they're meant to establish the king's trust in Robin and to satisfy Richard that Robin's men are true servants of England. But guess if Robin Hood plays out differently than we saw in the film, isn't that right?
It certainly does. Oh. Check this out. In The Guest of Robin Hood, the king has already seized Sir Richard at the Lee's lands and offered his lands to the person who brings him the head of Sir Richard at the Lee. The king is also angry that there are less deer around than normal, and he curses Robin and orders him to be brought before him. However, a guest of Robin Hood actually says that the king's name is Edward, which, based on the believed time period, suggests that the author meant Edward II, who was king of England and lord of Ireland from 1307 to 1327. However, later versions of the legends in the form of plays by Anthony Mundy. By the way, can you hear the name Mundy without thinking of Solomon Grundy?
Born on a Monday.
Yep. However, later versions of the legend in the form of plays by Anthony Mundy in 1598 called The Downfall of Robert Earl of Huntingdon and The Death of Robert Earl of Huntingdon, which were about Robin Hood but with a different name, placed the tale in the time of Richard I. In Anthony Mundy's plays, Robin Hood is driven to become an outlaw while Richard the Lionheart was away fighting the Third Crusade because of the misrule of Richard I's brother Prince John. The Scottish historian John Major, writing in 1521, placed Robin Hood's life as concurrent with Richard the Lionheart's reign from 1189 to 1199 as well. I'm guessing that is why WB chose that direction for the Adventures of Robin Hood, and later modern versions did too. Not only was it in the play, but it was noted by a historian who had access to manuscripts in 1521 that have long since crumbled to dust or been lost to time since then. But that little rabbit hole aside, after not being able to capture Robin or Sir Richard de Lee in 6 months in The Guest of Robin Hood, one of King Edward's foresters suggests to the king that he and about five of his men should dress as monks, and he will lead them into the forest where he will meet Robin Hood, and there they will capture him. The king agrees, but in The Guest of Robin Hood, he puts on a wide abbot's hat to conceal his identity further. But that went down a bit differently in the film, didn't it, Steve?
It sure looks that way. It's clear that the history gets a bit garbled with all the retellings, and there's some of that with the film, too. The way it happens in the film is that King Richard the Lionhearted secretly returns to England, though it's never explained how he escaped from Leopold of Austria. The king and his retainers end up dressing as monks in robes to travel secretly, while Richard is gathering information about what's been going on in England while he's been away. In the meantime, John gets word that Richard is back, and he decides to send a disgraced former knight named Dickon to assassinate the king. Dickon is promised his knighthood back as well as Robin's old lands if he succeeds. The assassination fails, as Marion overhears the conversation and then sends her handmaid Bess to warn Robin, but not before Gisburn arrests Marion for treason. But they're not able to stop Bess from reaching Much, who goes out alone to kill Dickon. In the meantime, Robin accosts Richard Party when they enter Sherwood, not realizing at first that he's the king. Richard eventually realizes that Robin and his men are loyal to him, and he reveals his true identity to Robin and the Merry Men. But there's a little bit more about that tale you wanted to talk about, Mike?
There is just a bit more. In The Guest of Robin Hood, Robin Hood invites the disguised King Edward to dinner after seeing that he bore the seal of the king. When they all get back to where Robin Hood and his men are staying, Robin blows a horn to assemble the merry men, and they all take a knee and bow before him. This surprises King Edward, as Robin's men seem more willing to answer Robin's call than the royal men are to answer his own call. But during the feast, Robin Hood and Little John wait on the disguised king themselves and feed him of the finest foods, wine, and ale. When dinner is over, Robin sets up an archery demonstration for the disguised king. But King Edward says that the target is too far away. But in a very I'll show you kind of way, Robin says that anyone who misses the target will not only forfeit his arrows, he will be slapped in the face. The old slap bat, I love it. When Robin steps up to shoot, and in four shots, Robin hits the bullseye twice and splits the wand on both of those arrows with two more shots. But on the third try, Robin missed, and his men taunted him for it. Robin was a man of honor, though, and he approached the disguised King Edward and gave him his arrows and presented himself for the slap. At first, the king declined, saying that the rules of his order forbid such an action. But Robin declares, "Do it." And so the king rolls up his sleeve and slaps Robin good and proper, knocking him right onto the ground. But the king also reaches to help Robin, and in that moment, Robin recognizes his king. And both he and Sir Richard at the Lee take one knee and bow before him. Robin then asks for mercy for him and his men, and the king and King Edward grants it. The king then invites Robin to join Edward's royal court. "Only if I can bring my men with me," Robin replies. The king asks if Robin has any green clothes so that he and his men can exchange their black cowls for one of Lincoln green. Back to Nottingham, the king commands. With feasting, drinking, and singing, the king welcomes Robin and his men into his service and restores Sir Richard's lands. But that went a little bit differently in the Adventures of Robin Hood too, didn't it, Steve?
For sure. Some of those details were actually used during the archery tournament and not during the ending scenes with King Richard. The shot where Robin splits the arrow in half was in an archery tournament, for instance. And the slap to Robin's face comes during his capture at Nottingham Castle, where Guy of Gisborne slaps him for his insolence. We do see the merry men all bowing before Richard when he's revealed, and Richard does get a fine meal from Robin. Other details from the story are also used towards the end of the film, though done a bit differently. After John and his followers are defeated, King Richard feels generous and offers Robin a reward for his loyal service. So Robin asks for a full pardon for all of his men, which he gets. The only other reward he asks for is the land of Lady Marian, which is also granted. And though Robin never asked for this, Richard restores Robin's titles, making him not only the Baron of Locksley, but also the Earl of Sherwood. So it's a retelling that uses details from Guests of Robin Hood, but the way that they're adapted works for this film. It's a satisfying ending, and it's pretty respectful to the material, even if it plays out differently. I also want to point out that the final scene as well, because the sword fight between Robin and Gisborne is really well done. It is a bit of a Hollywood sword fight where they're just clashing blades instead of trying to stick the pointy end in the other man, to quote Mask of Zorro. But it looks really good, and some of the shots are extremely clever. There's one point where Robin and Gisborne are fighting, and the camera shifts to their shadows on the wall as they're clashing blades. I mean, that's some really great cinematography, and it looks amazing on screen. I'll also add that by now, Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone are experienced in facing off against each other, having first squared off way back in Captain Blood. This was actually their second film together. Rathbone had sword fighting experience even before that, though. He served in World War I, and he was even the British Army's fencing champion twice. Wow. I mean, he taught people like Tyrone Power how to fight with a sword. So believe me when I say that Basil Rathbone was really good with a blade. That wasn't always true of Errol Flynn, though he got better after making a lot of swashbucklers. Flynn was really young and unrefined when he faced Rathbone and Captain Blood, much as I adore their fight in that film. Also, as an aside, I still quote Rathbone's 100,000 pieces of eight line as the French prior Levasseur from Captain Blood sometimes. That's how much I love their fight in that film. But by the time they did Robin Hood together, Flynn had really improved his swordplay. I mean, enough to really hold his own with Basil Rathbone, and they both sell this fight beautifully. The final battle from Robin Hood is honestly probably their best sword fight together. And that is saying something given how much I love Captain Blood.
That is saying something. You know, that stuff about Rathbone is actually pretty impressive. Honestly, I think with all of that experience, I feel like Rathbone could have worked with the fight choreographer a bit on the fight sequence itself. You know, a proper fencing duel would have been really awesome. But alas, it would seem that, as we both noted the same problem with the sword fight, it doesn't seem like they're trying to kill each other. They're, in your words, just clashing blades. If I'm honest, it reminded me a little bit of boys playing at sword fighting. In that respect, it was hard for me to feel a sense of danger about the fight. However, I would like you to note that I am in no way impugning Flynn's and Rathbone's performance. They did their jobs well and passionately even. My issue is with the fight choreographer here. Like you said, we have two powerhouse actors that are good enough to put on a great swashbuckling show, and he has them clashing blades the whole time. But fight choreography aside, I think that fight was well shot. Nice camera angles and a good mix of wide panels and close-ups. On a purely cinematographic level, it was beautifully done.
Right, and I think that's totally fair. I mean, it is very much a film of its time, and while it looks good, that battle absolutely is an old Hollywood-style sword duel. I mean, swordsmen in Hollywood would get much better later. I mean, you'd eventually have masters like Bob Anderson doing fight choreographies for later Flynn movies like The Master of Ballantrae, and then classic sword fights in movies like The Princess Bride, Highlander, Star Wars, and Lord of the Rings. Bob Anderson really changed the game when it came to Hollywood swordsmanship. I imagine he probably would have made Robin Hood look even better had he been around back then. But as it is, the fight at least looks cool and it's dramatic, even though it's clear that nobody's actually trying to kill each other. But is there anything else you wanted to add before we get to the more modern Robin Hood films, Mike?
Actually, yes. There's a random bit of information I'd like to share. I'm actually connected to this film in a kind of, you know, like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of way. Not all of it, but a lot of the film was filmed in the Bidwell Park in Chico, California, where I grew up for the most part. In fact, I have spent countless hours in Bidwell Park swimming, exploring, hiking, and cutting school. And I actually think I recognize a white tree that Much to Miller's son climbs that reaches across the stream. I don't know for certain, but it looks an awful lot like a tree at a swimming hole I used to go to in Bidwell Park. Anyway, there's more. I went to kindergarten up in the mountains at a school named the Springs of Living Water that shares the grounds with Richardson Springs Hotel. That is relevant because the crew that worked on The Adventures of Robin Hood stayed at that hotel. Like I said, 6 degrees, but, you know, like with locations.
Wow, that's awesome. It's always really nice when you can connect to some of the locations in a film. And there are some really beautiful locations in this film, especially out in the Sherwood Forest scenes. For my part, I really dig this version, even if I don't watch Robin Hood quite as much as Flynn's other pirate films. But Errol Flynn was a perfect Robin, and I think he owned that role better than anyone else I've seen to date. But why don't we get into the next adaptation on our list?
Hell yeah. And I'll add that I'm actually really excited about this one. As I mentioned earlier, it had a bit of big effect on me as a 15-year-old boy, and it has a nostalgic connection to a good time I had with my sister. Of course, I'm talking about Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which came out in 1991, based on the English folktale of Robin Hood that originated in the 12th century and is in many ways an homage to or taken directly from The Adventures of Robin Hood from 1938. That's actually a common theme you're going to see going forward. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves was directed by Kevin Reynolds and stars Kevin Costner as Robin Hood, Morgan Freeman as Azim Eddin Bashir Al-Bakir, Christian Slater as Will Scarlet, Nick Brimble as Little John, Michael McShane as Friar Tuck, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio as Lady Marian, Michael Wincott as Guy of Gisborne, Geraldine McEwen as the evil witch Mortiana, and Alan Rickman as the Sheriff of Nottingham. Bess, Marion's lady-in-waiting in The Adventures of Robin Hood, is replaced by Sarah's character, played by Imogen Bain.
This movie's probably the most successful version of Robin Hood since the 1938 film, even if it's a little less influential. It does influence modern versions of the character noticeably, though. Still, I think it holds up quite well. The Sheriff is one of Alan Rickman's most memorable villain roles, and he's played quite a few of them. The cast in general is pretty solid, but beyond Alan Rickman, I have to especially point out Morgan Freeman and Michael Wincott, and they're good in just about everything they're in. But why don't we get into where the film started?
Sure thing, Steve. Penn Densham wrote a 92-page outline for the film, which was turned into a screenplay by his producing partner, John Watson. In the outline that Densham wrote, he abandoned the traditional account of Robin Hood as a devil may care, best done by Errol Flynn in the 1938 classic we just discussed. Instead, he reimagined Robin as a spoiled brat rich kid that is transformed into a socially conscious rebel by 5 years in a dark prison in Jerusalem during the Third Crusade. I think this worked as a means of bringing someone of nobility like Robin of Lochley down to earth where he would meet Little John and his merry men.
True. Not that he necessarily needed that. I mean, he was never that high born in the first place, but I think it was an approach that worked for the character in this film. The Crusader background also explains how Robin becomes both a good fighter and someone who's capable of fighting a guerrilla war. Guy of Gisborne even notes this when he's surprised that Robin is able to beat him and kill several of his men. That implies that he really wasn't that much of a fighter before heading out to fight the Saracens, and that it was years of war and then his time in prison that hardened him up.
Robin's experience in the Crusades does add a really important element to the story, like you said. That's one of the reasons I tend to want to place Robin Hood during the time of King Richard's Crusades. So that is a very important point. Now I want to get into the film, but we need to clear something up first. I'm going to tell you right now that the version of Robin Hood, the Prince of Thieves, that most folks watch is not the same one that I watched. I watched an extended version, which is 12 minutes longer than the theatrical cut. This cut adds a whole evil backstory to the Sheriff of Nottingham by making him part of a cult of Satan worshippers that are taking over England. It adds layers to the Sheriff's trying to impregnate Marian, as her royal blood will make his dark and twisted seed take the throne of England. But he's just a man, you say. What do you mean, his dark and twisted seed? Well, the sheriff is the son of Mortiana, and she described the blood in her veins as making the sheriff's seed dark and twisted because she herself is so evil. It is also revealed that Mortiana has been spying on the sheriff through peepholes in the walls, and this causes the sheriff to doubt her clairvoyance. The lords that the sheriff is sending all the gold to in order to bribe them into aligning with him against King Richard. Yeah, they're all Satanists. What's more is that we learned that the greedy Bishop of Hereford, a Robin Hood character from the 1670s, has been working with these satanic lords who killed Lord Locksley, Robin's father, to frame or recruit lords into their alliance. Friar Tuck says that he has done this to countless men. This version actually explains why Friar Tuck was so angry with the bishop.
Yeah, understandably so. I mostly really like Prince of Thieves, but you touched on the one thing that bothers me about it. I'll be honest, I was never a fan of the magic and Satanism angle of this film. That moves the film away from the more grounded, semi-historical representation of a folklore story, and more into straight fantasy. Mortiana is straight up invented for this film and was never a part of the legend, but I can overlook that bit. It's more that we're seeing elements of prophecy and dark magic as part of the story, and specifically of the sheriff's background. It just doesn't feel like a natural fit to me. Also, I don't think it's really that necessary to the Robin Hood story. I think you could have done just fine by saying that the sheriff wanted to be king by marrying Marian and securing his own claim to the throne. You really didn't need this weird satanic bloodline thing to have a villainous plan. It's almost like there was a meeting where someone asked, like, how could they make the sheriff even more evil? And they just decided to make them Satanists for that reason. I mean, you have Alan Rickman as your sheriff. That's all you need if you want to be evil. But seriously, I don't think that all these elements ruin the movie or anything. It's just something that kind of bothers me and fell out of place and unnecessary to me.
You know, I hadn't really thought about it like that before, but it definitely does add that layer of fantasy to the story that is not in the legend. And I don't know, being a fantasy fan on that level, I kind of like it, even if it's a clear deviation.
Yeah, that's fair. I can see where it might bother you less than it did me. I guess I'm more of a fan of keeping it semi-historical and within the realm of plausible, and not everybody will necessarily see it that way, and that's fine. But speaking of semi-historical, why don't we get some of the connections with the tales, Mike?
I'd be glad to. There is a scene in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where Robin defeats six men, including Guy of Gisborne. But later, when Wolf retells that story, he says that Robin beat 12 of the sheriff's men. What's interesting about that is that Robin beating 12 of the sheriff's men comes right out of the very first Robin Hood story I mentioned earlier, Robin Hood and the Monk. When Robin is fighting the sheriff at the climax of the movie, Robin's blade is cut in two, and that is also from that same story.
I did like that little detail. It shows that even at the time, Robin's legend is embellished and exaggerated to make him look awesome. It does seem like they did their homework with this movie. But that's not all that they included, isn't that right?
No, it is not, my friend. I mentioned that Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves is in many ways an homage or taken directly from The Adventures of Robin Hood from 1938, despite abandoning or altering some of the more traditional elements, like changing Will Scarlet's character. But let me go down a list of scenes that, in my opinion, totally call back to scenes from it. Granted, it was much the Miller's son in The Adventures of Robin Hood that it happened to, but I think Wolf getting chased down for the killing the deer because he and his people are starvers and needed the meat thanks to the sheriff's taxes is a nod to much the Miller's son killing Prince John's deer because he and his people are starving because of Prince John's taxes. But that's not all from that scene. Robin Hood interfering with Guy of Gisborne and his men punishing much the Miller's son, like Robin did saving Wolf and Robin Hood, the Prince of Thieves. Also, you'll note that in both cases, Guy of Gisborne is given a message to give by Robin Hood concerning the treatment of his people. In The Adventures of Robin Hood, the message is for Prince John, and in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, it was a message to the sheriff.
Yeah, the role of Prince John gets completely written out so that the sheriff becomes the main villain of the movie. Guy of Gisborne gets demoted to the main henchman too, but there are a lot of callbacks to the 1938 film. I did remember noticing that Wolf is dropped into the role of Much the Miller's son early on. At the same time, the nods are pretty subtle, and if you don't know the legends of the previous film too well, it's possible to miss them completely.
That is certainly true, but I honestly love stuff like that. I love that there are little gems to be discovered with a bit of research, and that makes it fun. But let's talk a bit more about the nods and references to the adventures of Robin Hood. In the adventures of Robin Hood, Robin says that he will start a revolt and exact a death for a death. Robin makes a similar pledge in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, but he turns it up to 11 by saying he will turned it on them tenfold. Robin starts shit at the castle and escapes on horseback, like when Robin goes to the church to get answers but runs into the sheriff and slices his face, essentially declaring war by saying, "And so it begins." And he escapes too on horseback. And speaking of escapes, Robin Hood, Azim, and Duncan escaping on the horseback into Sherwood Forest is a callback to when Guy of Gisborne and the sheriff's men chase Will Scarlet, carrying Much the Miller's son on the back of his horse, as they and Robin Hood escape into the forest. The montage of the soldiers going around and punishing everyone because of Robin and the adventures of Robin Hood is called back to in the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves by Guy and Gisborne leading the sheriff's men around to burn out, assault, and threaten the families of the merry men. Robin Hood is called back to in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves by Guy of Gisborne leading the sheriff's men around to burn out, assault, and threaten the families of the merry men. So are the people coming to Robin Hood for help afterwards. Little John telling Robin that he stirred up a bloody hornet's nest now when he gets back from ruffling the sheriff's feathers at mass is a line straight out of the adventures of Robin Hood.
Yeah, that's right. I did remember the shape escape in the Sheriff Forest was familiar, and the escape from the church felt something like the 1938 might have done. So there are some familiar beats in it, but again, nothing that's too obvious, and they're dressed up fairly well. I do like it that in this version, the sheriff's punishment of the common folk gets taken up to 11. The sheriff's goons are roughing people up. They're destroying property, and they're even killing people, which is ironically making it harder for the sheriff to get what he wants from them. I mean, you can't exactly tax people who are dead and or unable to make a livelihood. But I do think it makes sense that Robin has pissed the sheriff off to such an extent that he's reacting out of anger and not his own self-interest. I mean, he's clearly hit a nerve, and it has violent consequences.
And call off Christmas. That kind of goes back to that thing we were talking about with Robin Hood and his pride and arrogance earlier. The very thing that allows him to do what he does is also the thing that can bring him down. I think that perhaps this nods to that, but is used with the sheriff instead.
Oh, absolutely. It also shows that there are consequences to Robin constantly trolling the villains. At some point, a monster like the sheriff is going to target innocent people in his rage. I think maybe Robin hoped that by making himself a target, that the sheriff would focus on him instead of the common folk, but I think he miscalculated there. But Robin heads up on the short end of the stick in a different scene. So what can you tell us about that?
Robin and Little John fighting in the river with quarterstaffs, and Robin getting his butt kicked initially in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, is a callback to Robin Hood getting his butt kicked by Little John with the quarterstaffs on the bridge over the river in the adventures of Robin Hood. I will add that I loved Azim's advice. Get up, move faster. And Robin's like, yeah, great idea. I don't know. That just cracked me up. You know, the obvious move to the spectator might not always be the most obvious move for the fighter. And I just like that. But there were other scenes as well. Robin Hood standing up on the log and giving a speech about what they're going to do. And everybody is joining in is directly called back to in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, when Robin does the same thing in different words to Little John and his men. Speaking of speeches by Robin, both Robins recruit their respective Friar Tucks by saying that his men are in need of spiritual guidance, or in Costner's words, an honest man to minister to them. And last but not least, Robin convinces Lady Marian he is on the right path by showing her that what they've been doing and proving that they are not stealing it in both films.
The quarterstaff fight was nice to see, though I find it interesting that they use much beefier quarterstaffs in this version. I also love this version of the fight because the terrain is used really well. The water can get pretty deep, and there are even small waterfalls that can trip a person up, and they do. Also, this version of Robin can occasionally fight dirty, and that ends up being a thing that helps him win the fight in the end. So even though they recreate an iconic moment, it plays out differently enough that it works for this film. I love a lot of the 1938 film's action scenes, like that final sword fight, but I think I prefer the quarterstaff fight in the Costner version. As for Marian, I like the idea that Robin was planning to use the stolen money to help pay King Richard's ransom. That's actually a good use for the sizable war chest that Robin had built up by that point. It draws a bit on the 1938 version, but it ended up being rendered moot in that film because of Richard's convenient return. But anyway, Robin's loyalty to Richard also convinces Marion to his side. And so that scene kind of fulfills two purposes. It's a well thought out scene.
It really is well done. In my opinion, studios would be hard pressed to do better than Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. I guess my final thoughts on the film would be that it is really well written, in my opinion. And I'll also add that the score and songs really added a lot to the magic of the film. To this day, it is one of my all-time favorite Kevin Costner's roles, and it is by far my favorite Robin Hood movie. As I mentioned before, I was immediately inspired to write a Robin Hood comic book as soon as I got home from the theater when I was 15. I drew and wrote out the first several pages of that comic book that night. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves made me a Robin Hood fan, so much so that it inspired me to do this episode on Robin Hood. I was pleasantly surprised to find out that Steve was a big fan, too. But do you have any final thoughts on the film before we move on, Steve?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good film. I have a few quibbles with it, but it's entertaining and it's well cast. I feel like there's a certain level of reverence for the legends, the history, and the 1938 film, while feeling very much like its own movie. Costner can be somewhat hit or miss for me, depending on the role, but I think he really worked in this movie, even if I prefer Errol Flynn. He adds more of a Han Solo type of roguishness to the Robin character, rather than being a full-on gentleman thief, and I think that's not a bad take at all. But let's move on to our next film.
That sounds like a good idea, Steve. However, I don't have a whole lot of Robin Hood-related material to talk about with the next film. The 2000 film by Ridley Scott bears little resemblance to the Robin Hood legends from Robin Hood's Surname of Longstride, which I can't find a single reference to outside of this film, the death of King Richard in the film. They throw in familiar names so they can stick the Robin Hood name on it, but this film is unlike any other Robin Hood story that I am personally aware of. But if you ignore all of that, then it's an entertaining film.
That's a bit surprising given how Ridley Scott is known for doing some pretty strong historical films. The Last Duel comes to mind as a recent example, and that was decently on the mark when it comes to historical accuracy. Even a film like Gladiator, while it made departures from Roman history, got a lot right as well. So the fact that this film strays so far from the legend is a bit surprising. I haven't seen it, but Russell Crowe was an interesting choice to play Robin at the very least. Maybe it might be worth seeing at least once.
It is definitely worth watching and really is a good movie, in my opinion. It's just not really a Robin Hood story. I mean, so if you go into it knowing that it's not meant to retell the legend as it is known, then the film can be a lot of fun. And it's obviously very epic with my man Ridley Scott at the helm. But I think there was another Robin Hood film that fits a similar description of not adhering to the established story. Isn't there, Steve?
Unfortunately, there is. In 2018, they made another attempt at a Robin Hood film, this time directed by Otto Bathurst and starring Taron Egerton as Robin. I don't recommend it. The setup borrows some elements from Prince of Thieves, with Robin being drafted to fight in the Crusades and then meeting a Moorish prisoner that he teams up with. The difference is that this movie really doesn't pretend to get very much right at all. And even the opening narration by Friar Tuck basically tries to prime you to accept changes from the lore and the history. I mean, for instance, the Jamie Foxx Moorish character that is the Morgan Freeman role turns out to be Little John. Yeah, no. Will Scarlet turns out to be one of the villains of the film, and this version has nothing to do with Will from either the legends or the previous films. The battles get a little ridiculous, too. The Crusade scenes look like a modern war movie, except everyone is using bows instead of guns, and Saracens are doing parkour and ninja moves. I mean, I'm not an expert, I admit that, but my guess is that this is not how medieval siege warfare would have been fought in the 12th century. Just saying that. To the film's credit, I will say that Taron Egerton is a good choice to play Robin Hood, and he has gotten better since Kingsman. The cast isn't bad at all, with people like Jamie Foxx, Ben Mendelsohn, and even F. Murray Abraham in notable roles, but it's clear that the filmmakers just didn't care about the history or the source materials, and audiences didn't care for the film either. This movie was a critical flop, and it was so poorly received at the time that it was nominated for 3 Razzies, including Worst Prequel, Remake, Ripoff, or Sequel.
God damn. You know, I'm a huge cinephile, and I usually like to watch all the movies. But I have to say, I'm happy I did not watch 2018's Robin Hood after your description. That sounds utterly horrible. And they did something similar with the narration in a Ridley Scott film. It was all about saying they were going to change a lot. But we've reached the final segment of this episode, and that is where we talk about Robin Hood's influence on at least one of my favorite DC characters, Green Arrow. I'm not sure how my man Steve feels about Green Arrow, but I'm sure he'll get into that. Green Arrow, despite being modeled after Robin Hood in a few ways, works as perhaps a modern Robin Hood, but I could only find a few things that they really actually have in common. The first is Green Arrow's costume, of course. That was obviously modeled after the costume worn by Errol Flynn in The Adventures of Robin Hood. And in The Adventures of Robin Hood, they dressed him like that because they were doing a movie in Technicolor and needed bold and bright colors that would match the forest. The other thing is, of course, that all Oliver Queen and Robin Hood are the best archers that have ever been. Also, Oliver Queen, while he didn't start out that way, became a man of the people and a political activist despite being a wealthy business owner. Robin Hood was also a man of the people, and he too became a political activist despite being a nobleman. What's more is that Robin Hood and Green Arrow also employ guerrilla tactics to take down large numbers of people and fight against injustice.
Well, since you asked, I'll start by talking about my own take on Green Arrow. I mean, he's strangely not a character I've ever connected to that much, despite my liking the archer hero archetype. I think my problem with Ollie is that he's very often a loudmouthed and arrogant jerk in the comics, and that makes him a bit hard for me to connect to. I do like the Arrow family, though. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Connor Hawke, and I like Roy Harper as a fan of the Titans. Actually, when written well, I really appreciate Roy, just because making him a father allowed him to mature in a way that Ollie never did. That version of Roy even managed to join the Justice League at one point. And Connor has that cool warrior monk thing going on, even though he's trying to keep his father's hot blood in check, and I love that conflict. But to get back to Ollie, there have been Green Arrow stories I've enjoyed. I mean, most recently, the Rebirth run by Benjamin Percy. But there's no way I could talk about Green Arrow even briefly without mentioning Mike Grell, who casts a huge shadow on that character. But anyway, there's no question that Green Arrow was always intended to be a modern-day Robin Hood. I mean, he's the world's greatest archer, wearing a green costume in the style of Robin Hood. There have even been times when the comics themselves admitted and leaned into that. Dinah's florist shop was called Sherwood Florist. the classic Neil Adams design draws a lot from the Robin Hood influence. I mean, beyond that, Ollie is the son of wealth and privilege who's fighting against the system. Even the idea that Robin spent years away from home comes back with Oliver Queen, who likewise spent years learning the bow while he was stranded on a deserted island. I'd argue that Robin Hood and Batman are probably the two biggest influences on Green Arrow.
I can certainly see that. In fact, now that you mention it, Robin Hood's father was killed, and that was the catalyst for his transformation into the character we know as Robin Hood. As everyone knows, Oliver Queen lost his father like Robin Hood did, as well. And as you mentioned, Batman lost his parents. So that is something all three actually have in common. But I believe there was another thing that even one of the Merry Men, Robin Hood's companion, shares with one of Green Arrow's companions. Isn't there, Steve?
Yes, that's definitely another point that's worth bringing up. You mentioned before we came on that Roy Harper as Speedy was kind of like a modern version of Will Scarlet. That's a great observation, and it's spot on in my view. They're both younger relatives of their respective heroes. I mean, Will is Robin's half-brother, and Roy is the adopted son of Oliver Queen. In some of the retellings, Will Scarlet was often described as a teenager, and Roy was a teen when he first debuted. Also, it's very probable that Roy's original design as Speedy was influenced by Will Scarlet, especially the red color scheme. Those early costumes probably were influenced by the 1938 Robin Hood film. So even though Speedy probably took some cues from Dick Grayson as Robin, I think he draws noticeably from Will Scarlet as well.
That's pretty cool, actually. There are even more connections there than I thought. I'm a big Arsenal fan who, for those who don't know, was once called Speedy. But I think I'm actually even a bigger fan of him now that I know he too is connected to Robin Hood's legend.
It does give a larger appreciation of Roy Harper to know how deeply he's connected to the source. But I think the beauty of Robin Hood is that he's been in popular consciousness for so long that the legend is now in the public domain. And that allows for so much room for creativity in telling different stories with Robin Hood and his Merry Men, whether it's using classic tales or just creating a new character based on the legend, as in the case of Green Arrow. So, Mike, can you tell me about your Robin Hood story?
I was blown away by Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves when I was 15. I've talked a bit about how I made my first comic when I was 12 called The Warrior, but there were others, and Robin Hood was one of them. Actually, the last one I would make for quite a while. I have been out of practice for some time, but there was a time I was a decent artist. Not amazing or anything, but good enough to tell the story and draw the occasional good splash page. As far as the writing goes, I didn't have too much plotted out, but I can tell you that I knew almost nothing about Robin Hood of Legend, beyond what I had seen in the Disney movie and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. To say that I was going to take some liberties with the legend is an understatement. I don't remember everything that I had in mind for the story. I know that it was going to take place right after Prince of Thieves, the Prince of Thieves films. And in the first issue, I had planned on Morgiana casting a spell that would possess the sheriff with a demon that gave him supernatural powers that bring him back from the dead. This was actually kind of inspired by my love of Ghost Rider, but that's a different thing. So Robin Hood and his men have to stop him again. As you could probably tell, I've been watching a lot of horror movies for a really long time and reading comic books for a really long time. But one thing that really made Robin Hood comic I was making different from the others was the elaborate backgrounds. I started adding in detail forest and castle scenes, whereas before the panels mostly contained the action I wanted to show. It was definitely an evolution in my art style. It was also the first time I was directly picking up a story from a film. I had used ideas from books and films before, but I had never written in another universe. What about you, Steve?
Well, what you described sounds almost like a fan fiction take of Prince of Thieves, though honestly, it sounds better than anything I wrote at 15. And honestly, I've written a fair amount of fan fiction in my time, and I really do consider it a good way to learn the craft. But to address your question, weirdly, I'll admit I actually haven't done much with Robin Hood directly to date, even though I'm a fan of the character. That said, I did create a Robin-like archer character as an antagonist for a superhero team I created called the Crown Guard. I called him the Red Thorn, and the basic idea is that he's a modern-day revolutionary in a country called Dragovia in the style of V for Vendetta, and he carries a magic Asgardian bow. I wanted the Red Thorn to be someone who was acting for his own agenda and ideology, but who was fundamentally sympathetic, even if his views are in conflict with the Crown Guards. We probably won't see him for a while in the Blitzverse, but he might be interesting to see as a Blitz character at some point. Still, doing this episode has really made me revisit the idea of including Robin Hood and maybe even doing something with Robin in the Omenverse. After all, it's always possible for the Guardians of Alaym to land in Sherwood Forest in the 12th century for a mission. I kind of want to see an archery match between Robin and Nazarin, who is probably the best archer among the Guardians. And I'm sure we'd catch sight of Lued as well along the way, but hopefully one day we'll get to that story.
You know, doing this episode has reignited that old flame I had for Robin Hood, and I absolutely love that idea of the Guardians going to Sherwood. In fact, I've got a few ideas about that, which I think we'll have to talk about later, so as not to potentially spoil anything, but I particularly love the idea of Robin meeting his match with a bow in Nazarin. In fact, I could see Robin's pride causing him to challenge her to a contest. That could be very cool. I'm also very intrigued by the addition of Lou into that story.
Yeah, that sounds great, and I look forward to doing more with this idea. I do love the idea of two very prideful characters like Nazarin and Robin trying to constantly one-up each other, so that's something we'll definitely have to explore. Anyway, that's all we have time for, so I think that draws our Robin Hood episode to a close. Robin Hood is a character that crosses many boundaries, from history to folklore to literature and film and so many other things. And there are so many adaptations we didn't get to talk about, more than we had time to cover. So feel free to sound off on your favorites if we missed any. So until next time, thanks for listening. And I'd also like to thank all of our patrons that made this podcast possible.
I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.